Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere on the air and online by Paul Everett's RV Country. With 8 locations in 5 western states.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Mike DeCesar of Madera, California, originally from New Jersey. And in 1946, after his time on submarines in World War II, a salvage diver aboard the USS Recovery. He was a plank owner, part of that ship's original crew. And he ended up being a guest of honor at her decommissioning nearly a half century later. But when we left off, he was explaining some of the dangers he and other divers encountered.
And when you describe those, you describe, you know, getting the bends or having the spread eagle. Those are not things that were theoretical or hypothetical or make sure this never happens. You guys knew that because you saw it happen to other people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's nobody there to help you. If you just happen to crack that valve and you just let too much air come in, because that compressor is pumping air. It's up to you
right. How
you want to control it. If you get too much air in, that suit will blow up explode. The suit itself will just inflate to a point where it would be physically impossible for you to bring your arms down to grab that valve, and
right. It's
over.
Yeah.
You know, what you'll do, you'll float to the surface. When you come to the surface, it'll pop, and like they say, you'll be in the helmet. Well, I'd never seen that, but that's what they told you.
Oof. No, thank you. And you mentioned some of the things that you would go diving after, and it just strikes me, given what you shared about your duty on subs at the end of World War II, where your whole purpose, you know, you had the occasional rescue missions, but most of the time you guys are trying to fire your torpedoes at enemy ships. Whether you're sinking cargo, you know that lives are at stake. Now, after the war, you're a diver on a salvage ship, the Recovery, which is hard to miss if you visit your office that you served on the Recovery. And that name is fitting because that's what you're doing. You're recovering, you're saving. Completely different purpose from destroying to saving.
Right.
And I get the sense that mattered to you, that made a difference or made it somehow more satisfying or more fulfilling for you?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, I think I showed you a couple of pictures. We had a Marine helicopter went down. Unfortunately, the pilot and his co-pilot didn't get out, but that was off the coast of Costa Rica. And we got the call on that. The waters, you know, down there, they're just so clear that it looked like they're 10 feet deep and it could be 200 feet. But, you know, you go down and you're not trying to look inside, see the bodies. What you're doing, you're down there and you've got what they call cable straps, and you cable it where you think that it's going to hold so they can bring it back up. And of course, once they bring it up, they put it on the fantail or the stern of the ship and they cover it. You don't touch the bodies. You don't have anything to do with that. You know, on another occasion, there was a C-45, which is a twin engine, twin tail. That crashed. That was Air Force. And that was off of Puerto Rico.
Yeah, and you've got a picture of you guys pulling that thing up.
Yeah, I think the one that I really stands out the most was the salvaging of a T-2 tank of the Royal Oak, which ran aground off of Ecuador and was sinking.
This is a really neat story. So this tanker runs aground, it's sinking, and you guys get the word to come to the rescue, but you've got a long way to go, right? You had to go through the canal to get there?
Yep. We were just coming in from Guantanamo Bay, and we're waiting in line to get into the first lock on the Atlantic side of the Panama Canal. And, of course, so-called station, or our shop, was right next to the yeoman. And the yeoman is like the ship's secretary. So first thing he does, I was just in the shop working on something. I don't know what it was. We had our table and our tools in there. And he walks, he runs in, he calls me, he says, "Hey, DeCesar," he said, "we got a great assignment." I said, "What are we doing?" He says, "Man, we're heading to Ecuador. I just heard from the radio shack." And off he goes. So we had priority to get through the canal. I think we got through. It normally takes about 7.5 hours. But we got through, and I think it was about 5 hours and 20 minutes, tied up to the docks at Balboa Sub Base. Single lump lines, just one line on the bow, one line on the stern. Took on water, took on fuel, took on food, and we're gone at flank speed. And of course, we have a general idea where this ship is at. But once again, we didn't have the sophisticated equipment. And our captain, who's an ex-merchant marine captain, he was a lieutenant commander. His name was Jack Moritz, M-O-R-I-T-Z. Great guy. He was not an academy guy, so he didn't believe in the book. He made an announcement. Whoever spots that tanker first gets a 3-day pass. Well, we had a young kid from L.A. He spotted it, and I climbed up the foremast with my camera. I took a picture of it, and it was on a 32-degree list.
That is severe.
That's very severe.
And you have that picture that you took
on
your wall in your office. I'll put it up at hometownheroesradio.com. But I just wanted to mention that that's severe because some people who don't know what a 32-degree list is, I mean, it's getting pretty close to capsizing.
Well, if it didn't have fuel in the tanks, it would have capsized.
Yeah.
So it ripped open two tanks is what it did, and it was gasoline. When we spotted it, the crew was all in lifeboats, but they left one man on board. And the reason for that, there was a Grace Lines cargo ship that wanted to claim salvage rights. But as long as you have one live body on board, they can't do that. And I think he was the engineering officer. So they got all the crew on board the recovery, and then our salvage officer, I think he was on vacation, so they wanted an assessment of what we thought if we could save it. So we went over with the chief boatswain mate, machinist mate, ship fitter, myself, one other diver. You can imagine climbing on that ship that's at a 32-degree list. I mean, you're pulling yourself up is what you're doing.
Yeah.
So we thought that if we could get a compressor, we can cut some panels and weld them over where the hull was ripped, we'd be able to pump it out. Of course, the recovery, like the rest of the ARSs, that's all power. They have huge stripper pumps on them to pump water out. So they pumped the water out, and we got it up from a 32-degree list to a 2-degree list, and we towed it back to Panama to the Panama Shipbuilding Company. To me, that was one of the most memorable salvage operations that I was on.
What all did you have to do to get it back into that situation, you personally?
Well, there was two divers and there was three apprentice divers. They were cutting sheet metal panels that are between compartments. Mm-hmm. And they would cut them, and then you're very buoyant under the water. And then we'd get it over top of where the hull was ripped, and then we would weld it.
That's what I wanted to establish. You had to dive under the surface, go down to these damaged portions of the ship, and repair them under the water?
Yeah, the tanks are 40 feet deep.
Uh-huh.
So... yeah, you're underwater. Then once you do that, they put their stripper pumps on and they pump it out. That damn stripper pumps, they're like, I think, 18-inch diameter. They shoot water out 100 feet, and you can just see it coming up.
Was there some anticipation for that moment, thinking, is this going to hold? Is this going to work right? Or did we miss something under there?
No, the only anticipation was don't start sliding again because it was on a shelf.
Uh-huh. It had hit something under the surface that they couldn't see.
And it was right there at an area called Punta Galera, right off of the northwestern section of Ecuador.
And that was 1946.
1946.
But the memory of that ship came around many years later in your work life.
Yeah. I was with working for National Flood Insurance, and I had this claim with a captain in the sheriff's office. His house suffered about 6 or 7 feet of flood water. When it receded, I was handling that case for him, and I went in, and I happened to notice on the wall, I says, oh, that's a T2 tanker. And he goes, oh, you know about those? And I said, yeah, I was a salvage diver. In fact, I helped rescue one of those. And he goes, where was it? And I said, it was off the coast of Ecuador. And he said, was it called the Royal Oak? And I was shocked. And I said, yeah, how do you know? He said, my grandfather was the captain. That was his last trip. He left, he came back, and he gave me a cardboard box, and it had everything in it, the ship's log and everything else, which I have. What a small world. And this is what? Back in around 1994, I think, when they had the 500-year flood.
So almost 50 95. Years later.
Yeah, almost 50 years later. And if I didn't see that picture, I'd have never known it.
Right, but he got to meet one of the guys who saved his grandfather's ship.
Yeah, and saved his grandfather, because the crew, believe it or not, we had his grandfather under guard in the recovery's dispensary because they threatened to kill him.
For running aground.
Yeah.
Wow.
And if anyone's listening that was on that ship, the guys, they were something else. They were the dirtiest bunch of guys you ever seen. The guys chewing tobacco, spitting on the deck on the inside of the compartments. The boatswain mate would just run them out. But it was okay. It saved them all.
Looking back over everything we've talked about, and I'm sure we could stay here for hours and hours listening to some of your stories, but for a kid who never knows his mother, never has the opportunity really to get to know his siblings, goes cross-country on a train at age 9 to live with people that you didn't know, to have experienced all these things since then. I mean, what are the odds that a story that starts out like that takes all the twists and turns and arrives at where we are today? How do you explain all that?
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of people in this country and in this world that have probably followed the same road that I have. It's what you want out of life, what you want to do. If you want to just flip hamburgers and you're happy with that, so be it. I was happy working on the farm, even though it was hard, but I wanted something better. I knew nothing about United States Armed Forces Institute to get a high school diploma. I didn't know anything about the GI Bill, but when I found out about it, I said, I want it, and I worked for it. Nobody handed it to me, and I look at today, a lot of people say, your age, why are you working? Number one, I like to help people. That's why I'm an advocate for policyholders to see that they get what they really have coming to them. It's just a feeling and the satisfaction you get helping people.
So how long are you going to keep working?
That's another part of a story. I recently testified in a case in Modesto, and the attorney for the insurance company inquiring my age, he asked a question that you should never ask, using the word why. Why are you working at your age? And I looked at him and I said, Your Honor, this is somewhat of a sensitive subject. Do I have to answer it? And he looked at me and he said, well, go ahead, and if it gets to a point, I'll stop you. But we had retired military on the jury. Of course, I'm wearing my hat because at the time, the high-intensity lights, my right eye only had 20% vision until I had surgery.
And your hat is a hat that says World War II veteran.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they're connecting with me.
Yep.
And I asked the judge, is it at all possible, could I wear my hat because of this condition? And what would happen? I said, 1946, I fell off a ship's mast and broke my neck, and the calcium is pressing against the optical nerve, and I'm supposed to have surgery in 2 weeks. He said, I got something better. He tells the deputy, turn the bank of lights off. This is a new building, high-intensity lights. And I wouldn't. 20 minutes, I wouldn't be able to read a document. I would get a kaleidoscope. So to answer the attorney, and after the judge says, well, go ahead, I looked at the jury, and this is exactly what I said. My oldest son did 8 years in the United States Navy nuclear submarines. When he was discharged, he moved back east, he married a woman, he had children. He joined the police department. 14 years later, he lost his life while he was on duty. I made a promise that I would see that his children went to college. They are going to college, and I pay for their entire college. They have 2 years to go. When they graduate, I will then retire. So that's why I'm working at my age. I am told that there were two female jurors that were crying. That jury came back with a combined general and punitive damage on a claim that was $877,000 for $10.5 million.
I guess they shouldn't have asked you why you're still working, huh?
Should never ask that question why unless you know the answer.
But, you know, by telling me that story, you opened up one more question I have to ask you.
Sure.
We didn't talk about you falling from a mast. That could have killed you.
Well, what had happened, we were at sea. It wasn't rough, but we were doing maybe 10-degree rolls side to side. And I was down in the motor control room on watch. It was nighttime. And, of course, at that time, ships would talk to each other with the lights off the yardarms, which is the crossbow on the main mast. The phone rang. I answered it, and they said, some of the lights are out on the forward mast. We have what we call an apprentice in the Navy. We call him a striker electrician. He's an apprentice. Mm-hmm. I said, go up to the foremast and change them bulbs up there. It's probably a couple of bulbs. So about 20 minutes later, the bridge calls back down again. We were on our way back to Panama. They said, what seems to be the holdup? I said, I don't know, but I'll find out. I went up and the young fellow was sitting on the anchor windlass machine, which is a huge machine that pulls the anchor up. I says, what are you doing? He said, I can't climb the mast. I said, why can't you climb it? I'm scared. I said, there's nothing to be scared about. He said, but I can't go. I can't go. I said, give me your belt. So I went up, climbed it, shimmied out, which I've done before. And when I'm coming back, I'm on the third rung. These are like big U-bolts, but they're heavy iron or steel welded to the mast. A weld broke. Snag my jacket, and I'm swinging back and forth. They're coming up to get me, but the jacket tears. I fell 42 feet. I broke my neck, my wrist, my left hip.
And you didn't think this was worth mentioning before?
Not really. You asked me the question. I promise I'd answer you. So after all these years, I started to have this problem. But I'm fine now.
42 feet?
42 feet.
How are you alive?
Split my head wide open. How am I alive? Once again, faith. He was with me.
Must have been.
I was unconscious for 11 days.
Holy smokes. And that was 1946.
1946.
So. You were 18 years old.
Yep.
You should have died at 18. Really?
Yeah.
Who survives a 42-foot fall landing on their head?
Actually, I think when I hit, with my right shoulder and my hip, and then the rest of my body, like my head that was split across the front and my neck that broke. That was the second when my body went down, hit another part of the machinery.
Unconscious for 11 days.
Yep.
So when you come to, what are those moments like when you start to understand what happened and what kind of shape you're in?
Well, when I come to, I'm not moving very much. I got a thing around my neck. I got a cast on my arm. I've got a sling around my shoulder. Cast that goes almost halfway up and above my hip.
So most people would be thinking, boy, this is going to be rough.
I did, but once again, you know, I just asked for prayer. They said, you will probably be in the hospital for a good year and a half. Well, 5.5 months later, I was back on the ship with light duty.
Wow. Any other secrets I didn't ask you about you want to share, Mike?
No. We could sit here a long time. Once again, I'm going to reach out to young fellas and young girls. You know, we live in the valley here. There's a lot of people live in poverty. There's a lot of families that are struggling, that they want to do the best they could for their kids. But unfortunately, they did not have the opportunity that they could afford to do this. So some kids, they might start high school, they may never finish. They've got to go out, they've got to work to help their family survive. Those that do finish high school, unless they get grants, will never see the doors open going to college. If young people are listening to this and you feel that there's nothing for you, think about the service. Think about the benefits. If you don't want to go to college, you can learn almost anything in the military. Do that 20 years, you got lifetime retirement, got education waiting for you, you got a trade that can carry you through, and you got free medical for the rest of your life. That's something that I experienced, and I would encourage young folks, and I do.
Well said. Well, I there's something I don't want to forget to say, and that is thank you. Thank you for serving our country, for sharing some of your remarkable story with us. Is there anything else you wanted to say?
I think that's about it. I thank you, and I will say one thing. The service to me, the Navy, was one of the greatest parts of my life. I've had a lot of great parts, but that was one of the greatest. And I was very honored to do what little that I did, together with millions of other young men and women who are doing what they're doing today to hopefully keep this country free. And we all have to be with them. We have to have them in our prayers. I pray for them every night. And for those that lose their life, I pray that those gates will be left open so they'll have no delay going into that heavenly paradise.
Well, I trust that was the case for those two brothers of yours killed on December 7th, 1941. And I'm sure Victor and Vito would be very proud of their baby brother. What a story. Mike DeCesar, 88 years young. And if you enjoyed hearing from Mike and you'd like to hear a little bit more, the podcast version at hometownheroesradio.com features another 20 minutes or so with this spirited storyteller. You'll find photos and videos of Mike on the website too, as well as on Facebook if you just punch in Hometown Heroes Radio. Thanks for spending this hour with us. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.